by a long shot, and it sure wouldn't be the last. You'd think that a famous rock star being married to a gorgeous supermodel would be one of the greatest things in the world. It is. David Bowie. Fame. What's your name? What's your name? Just like my dad, I can look at my life and consider myself one of the luckiest men in America. If you had told me in 1967 that a second son of Irish immigrants would end up standing next to the President of the United States at a Rose Garden celebration of the world champion 2013 Red Sox, I would assume you were dosed on LSD. My mom always reminds me how proud she is of my success, while simultaneously making sure I keep my feet firmly on the ground. So my fame has never been allowed to go to my head. One example? I'm sitting in my dentist's waiting area in New York City, plucking at my phone, avoiding eye contact with everybody else. And I hear someone say, "Hey, man." And I look up to find Paul McCartney smiling down at me and saying sweetly, "I didn't want to bother you, but I just had to say hello." Okay, freeze frame. Let's ESPN this moment in my life. Paul McCartney, Sir Paul McCartney, who I first saw on TV in 1964, in The Beatles. Even my parents were fans. Is shaking my hand and smiling, having just apologized for bothering me. I slowly stand up so we're face to face, still shaking hands. Millions of musical questions are zipping into my head. 6 decades of great songs, thousands of meaningful moments in my life that his music underscored. I had so many things I could say. But I'm sure it comes as no surprise that what I chose to say was this. "Hey, Paul McCartney, what are you doing here?" "Getting my teeth cleaned," he said. He paused for a second, awaiting my next sentence, which turned out to be this. "Wow, me too." Then there was another pause, and I could see the friendly light in Paul's eyes beginning to dim as he realized he was stuck in a hero worship situation instead of a funny conversation with a fellow celebrity. So I said this, "Let me see how yours look," while madly beaming at him. "Okay," Paul replied. He reluctantly offered a semi-wide smile, his beetle teeth partially bared, and I went, "Oh my God, they look awesome. So white. Did you get them whitened, or are they always that white?" The normal neurons in my brain asked the moron motors currently operating it, "Did he just say the word white 3 fucking times? "Yes," the moron motors responded, "and we may even say it a few more." Paul appeared to be a little taken aback. So he said, "Let me see yours." I bared my non-beetle teeth. Too widely, I'm sure, because Paul seemed to step back an inch or two as he said, "Very nice. Well, see you later, mate. Good luck." And he left in what can only be described as a bit of a rush. For the first time, I noticed the other patients in the room, and each expression seemed to say, "What the fuck was that?" One guy actually offered a slight eye roll, shook his head at me, and smiled snarkily as he turned his attention back to a magazine. The vibe in the room was clear. I'd blown it. Totally blown the opportunity to become friends with a beetle. One of only 2 beetles left alive. Upon immediate mental review, I realized how weird and clumsy our conversation had been, all down to my inability to avoid what I call fan panic. As a doctor, I'm allowed to scientifically identify certain medical conditions, and fan panic is one I was actually first to diagnose and name. It's a series of anxiety-related reactions within the brain and body that afflict patients upon meeting someone they worship. I've actually witnessed it myself, fans who stammer and or shake as they try to get an autograph or pose for a picture with you. So imagine how often Paul McCartney has found himself dealing with fan panic, every day, for the last 50-something years. And then imagine his disappointment when he meets another famous guy and thinks he's about to have a fairly decent, funny little chat and instead gets another boring dose of panicky fan face. One more diagnosis of mine. Panicky fan face is when you look like a deer in the headlights as someone famous finally stands in front of you. And I realize now that I had looked like the craziest deer in the brightest high beam headlights ever made. So I did what you would have done after meeting a beetle and blowing it. I called my mom, skipping over the mistakes I'd just managed to make, and instead telling her how Paul McCartney, the Paul McCartney, had just walked up to say hello to me. Her first response was significantly valid. Did he think you were someone else? She said. That's the story of my famous life. Since the very first time I walked down the street circa 1992 and started to notice some side-eye glances and long, excited stares from random passers-by, the drug that is being famous was always dotted with built-in reality check speed bumps for me. Early on, I couldn't avoid learning lessons about just where I stood on the Hollywood ladder. I was walking through an airport in 1993 when a panicky fan face appeared in front of me, hands trembling as he asked me for an autograph, which I gladly signed, which almost immediately led to him pointing at my signature and asking, "What the hell does that say?" "All the best, comma Dennis Leary," I explained. The panicky fan face quickly morphed into angry, disappointed visage as he snapped, "God damn it, I thought you were Willem Dafoe. Someone said he was here." And off he went, dropping the signed piece of paper into a trash can. At first I was pissed. Willem fucking Dafoe? He's not funny, or tall, or even 100% Irish. Plus, I was Dennis fucking Leary, motherfucker, famous comedian. My name and face were all over the place. MTV, the movies, books, magazines, TV, CDs. I was a multimedia monster about to become a showbiz legend. Then I thought, hey, wait a minute. I might already be a legend. I'm being mistaken for an incredibly talented Oscar-nominated actor, respected for his striking dramatic work on the silver screen and the theatrical stage. So was born a career's worth of me being Willem. And I can only hope, vice versa. While I'm at JFK Airport hearing, "Hey, you were fantastic in Platoon," or "I love The English Patient," and "You blew me away in The Last Temptation of Christ," I can only hope Willem's at LAX wincing as someone mentions how much they love the Asshole song or Operation Dumbo Drop. And this happens everywhere on Earth. I was vacationing in Rome with my family once and stepped outside the hotel to have a smoke. Several people smiled and said ciao or come va or buongiorno as they walked past me in what seemed like a very enthusiastic manner. Clearly, they were fans of mine, my fame having reached across the ocean. The smiles indicating how stand-up comedy and the cinema form a truly international language. That evening at dinner, the same thing, except with smiles and buonasera. And the next day, the same love all over again. Until I went out to buy some cigarettes and the guy behind the counter said, "When you start smoking, Willem?" Come to find out, I was staying in the same neighborhood where Dafoe and his new Italian bride, Giada Colagrande, lived. There was no escaping the man. Willem and I became even further intertwined after we both became members of the Spider-Man family. For years, my Dafoe-by-default existence included airport security guards happily greeting me with, "Hey, it's the Green Goblin," almost every time I traveled. More than once, I got eased through long TSA lines because an agent would tag me with a variation on the phrase, "I loved you in Spider-Man," as he or she would usher me away from the shoeless masses. And I played right along, answering questions about what Tobey Maguire and James Franco were really like, and eventually, what a shame it was that there wouldn't be a Spider-Man 4. Then, in 2012, I got asked to play Captain Stacy, Emma Stone's fictional dad, in The Amazing Spider-Man, a reboot of the franchise. And all hell broke loose in airports around the planet. Guards would begin to argue as I entered their area. Here's one actual exchange I heard between four TSA members at Chicago's O'Hare Airport in 2014. "Hey, it's Captain Stacy." "Captain who?" "It's Green Goblin, asshole." "Green Goblin's from the old Spider-Man. Captain Stacy's from the new one. He's the chief of police." "So the bad guy's now a good guy? That's a kick-ass plot twist." "It's not a plot twist, motherfucker. He's Emma Stone's dad." "You're Emma Stone's dad? His ID says his name is Leary. So who's got the fake name? You or Emma?" There was a plot twist in the Dennis and Dafoe diaries a few years back when Willem did that Snickers commercial wearing a dress. Now every so often when I go through security, I also have to hear about how bad I look when I'm hungry and how short and skinny my legs are. I tried explaining the situation once, and when I got to the part about how some women would kill to have my girlish long legs, the guy just stared at me in disbelief and said, "You're holding up the line, sir." Airport security has always been a big-time barometer for how famous you are and what for. The personnel will often key in on your face and take the time to briefly talk about a film or TV show they liked or hated, and it's all relative. Because airport security is the great celebrity equalizer. Doesn't matter who you really are, it's who they think you are that matters. I remember going through security with the late great director Ted Demme and Bruce Springsteen back in the 90s after some award show in Los Angeles. Ted directed Bruce's celebrated music video for the song Streets of Philadelphia, the theme from the Oscar-winning Jonathan Demme film Philadelphia. The TSA staff was predominantly African-American, and, as I was being waved along, three of them erupted in smiles as they mentioned Who's the Man, a 1993 hip-hop comedy flick starring Ed Lover, Dr. Dre, and every rap and hip-hop star of that era, along with hot young comics like Bernie Mac, Bill Bellamy, etc., in which I'd done an extended cameo. The film had a big cult audience. I pointed out Ted, who directed it, and he became a little mini-celebrity for 90 seconds as they complimented him on his work and cleared him right through security. Which was when we noticed Bruce getting wanded. Being one of the world's most famous rock stars, Bruce had several rings, necklaces, bracelets, earrings, and chains adorning his body. And he had set off the metal detector multiple times. Right now, he had his arms in the air and a look of consternation on his face. "Hey, he's okay," Ted explained to the guard. "He's the boss." The woman with the wand was unimpressed. "He might be somebody's boss, but he sure ain't the boss of me," she retorted. "Turn around, Mr. Boss Man." As Bruce did so and smiled, she wanded him further. "He's Bruce," Teddy said. "He's cool." "It ain't cool to wear all this jewelry and whatnot and make my job harder, Mr. Bruce," she replied. "Bruce Springsteen," Teddy intoned, which finally rang a celebrity bell that made her stop and stare. And it dawned on me and Teddy and the boss simultaneously. Bruce's demographic doesn't include a lot of black people. So that night at LAX, Who's the Man trumped Born in the USA for one brief, shining moment, proving once again, we're all just people, some of us who wear a lot of jewelry. It's worth noting here that the first time I met Bruce was at a Tribeca restaurant in downtown Manhattan. Another friend of mine was directing a movie, and Bruce was considering doing the score for it. Walking in, I was greeted by Little Steven saying, "Dennis, Steve Van Zandt, this is Bruce. Hey, let me ask you a question." We were at one end of the empty bar, and my friend and a few other people were seated across the room, deeply engaged in conversation. Bruce had a sullen look on his face. Steven was very intense as he continued saying, "You call up your best friend and invite him to a wedding. You leave him a nice message. Now this is a guy you've known your whole friggin' life. And instead of calling you back to say, 'Yes, I'm coming,' or 'No, I can't make it,' the guy has his assistant call. Not him, his assistant. Now I ask you, is that or is that not a bullshit move, right?" So there I stood, with Bruce and Little Steven staring back at me, two rock icons awaiting my response. One so famous that just the mention of his first name was enough to identify him anywhere in the world, except maybe sometimes at airport security. The other one, so notable, his nickname was all he needed wherever he went, except, I'm assuming, at airport security, where they might mistake him for a pirate. But in this very moment, the power of fame was being called into question and weighed against regular guy friendship and common working class courtesy. I was still fairly new to fame at the time, but smart enough to know that in the celebrity pecking order, Bruce outranked Steven, and Steven outranked me. So just like in the army, I wasn't gonna fuck with our commanding officer. Even though Lieutenant Van Zandt was supposedly talking in abstract terms, it was clear that General Springsteen was the aim of his ire. Now, personally, in my brief reign in Fameland, I'd already had some run-ins with old friends and family members over wedding invites and birthday bashes I couldn't attend, often responding through my assistant because my schedule was so insane. Thus, my very diplomatic answer, which was this. "Perhaps, Steve, this best friend of yours is extremely busy and didn't want to keep you waiting. I mean, what's the difference, really, if it's his assistant or his wife calling you back, as long as someone makes sure you know what you need to know? By the way, if this best friend is coming, isn't that the most important part of the equation?" I almost didn't believe my own improvisational bullshit on that one, but it worked. Steve did what we would all come to know later on as one of his Silvio Dante talking to Tony Soprano understanding nods, turned to Bruce, turned back to me, and then said, "I never thought of it that way." So the boss and his best buddy clinked glasses and smiled at each other. Holy shit, I thought. This celebrity expressway sure is full of unexpected potholes. Another time when I met Bruce was also fraught with bizarre energy. Long story short, Ted and I were asked to develop an original angle for a Rolling Stones concert film of their Voodoo Lounge tour. Mick Jagger invited us to spend a few weeks watching the Stones rehearse and then attend the first couple of stadium gigs, shoot some backstage stuff, and get to know everyone in the band, which was exhilarating, especially when seconds after meeting Keith and Ron Wood, they started asking me questions about the Asshole song, and then started singing the chorus. That remains a career high point for me. All you need to know about the Stones is this. The real reason they are so great is because of how hard they work. Every day, at every rehearsal, they went all out with 150% high-energy musicianship. And then later, back at the hotel over drinks and dinner, they would pepper us with questions about how they sounded, what we thought of the set list, and were there any old songs we missed and thought might work better in the show. Jagger was a gem, one of the most charming, smart, dynamic, and funny people I've ever met, period. I brought my brother down to hang out for a couple of days, and Mick ended up fetching him a Heineken one night while asking what his favorite tunes were and why. I can still see the shock on my brother's face as Mick handed him a cold beer and waited to hear his opinion on Jumpin' Jack Flash. Keith was a tough cookie and the genuine musical director. There's a reason almost every Stone song kicks off with his riff ringing out first, and he doesn't miss a detail, on stage or off. Plus, he had a great laugh. As did Ronnie. Charlie was always the quiet guy with a sly smile and a polite hello every morning. The entire experience was like a dream. Mick and Keith made sure we got tickets for all of our friends and family members before we'd even considered asking. They were true gentlemen. Now, during this run, the MTV Video Music Awards were held in New York City, and both Bruce and the Stones were nominated in playing the show. I presented an award that night, and afterward, Teddy and I were hanging out backstage when the Stones finished playing. In the wings, Mick invited us to their private after party, which, of course, we said yes to. As Mick walked away, Teddy whispered out of the side of his mouth, "Don't tell Bruce we're going to the Stones party." "What? What are you..." "Shh, I told Bruce we would go to his party, but I'd rather go to the Stones, so just follow my lead." Half a second later, there was the boss. "Great job, man," Teddy said. "Amazing, Bruce. Just amazing," I chimed in. "Thanks, guys. So I'll see you later at the hotel," he said. This was when Teddy panicked. "Well, it turns out, Dennis has a thing," he said. This is when I panicked. My eyes almost fell out of my head, because Bruce's eyes were looking right into them. "Oh, you're having a party too," he said. "No, it's not a party," I said. "It's more like, you know, like a thing." Bruce seemed puzzled. "What kind of thing?" I looked at Teddy, seeking some kind of help. He didn't offer any. The fucker. So I said, "Well, it's just like a, you know what it is? It's a dinner thing. Bruce said, "Oh, well, why don't you guys come by after the dinner?" Still no help from Teddy. He waited for me to nervously answer with this improvisational genius. "Yeah, well, it's not just a dinner. It's a, dinner party kind of a thing. It's a benefit, actually." Don't ask me why I said benefit. Maybe because it sounded more official, which it did. For about 2 seconds. "Nice," Bruce said. "What's the charity?" This was the next great idea to fly out of my lying Rolodex. "Cancer, musicians with cancer," I said. "Oh," Bruce said, "that's cool. What's the name of it?" Here I turned the tables on Teddy. "What's the name of it again, Teddy?" And he turned them right back on me. "I don't know. It's your event," he said, "not mine. I'm just going to support a great cause." Then there was a long and awkward beat of silence. I guess Bruce was waiting for me to come up with the name, which I was desperately asking my brain to create, which it didn't. So Bruce gave me a suspicious look and said, "Okay, well, good luck with that. Teddy, I'll see you next week in L.A. Have a good night, boys." And away he went. There was another awkward pause as we both stood there with frozen smiles on our faces until Bruce was safely out of earshot. Then I said, "You think he bought it?" "A fucking cancer dinner party benefit thing," Teddy said, "with no name? Who the fuck would buy that?" Needless to say, we went to the Stones party, which the Stones weren't at. But I did come up with a great name for my imaginary event. Tunes Against Tumors. I know, it sucks. Teddy thought so too. And you can bet your ass the boss wouldn't have bought it. I ran into Mick Jagger a few more times over the years, and he not only always remembered me, but remained his very charismatic self. And I saw Keith again about 8 years later, in the strangest of circumstances. While on vacation in the Caribbean with my wife and a few other couples, and went down to the beach solo early one morning to catch some rays and enjoy the peaceful view. It was absolutely empty, just me and the birds. When off in the distant waves, something caught my eye. Slowly emerging from the water, a human head, like Martin Sheen in Apocalypse Now. Inch by inch, black hair. Then, open eyes, followed by a weathered face. Then, the rest of a very tan and slender man, in a pair of denim shorts, and what looked like an unbuttoned woman's blouse, open to the navel and tied off just above his waist. Within a few seconds, I realized it was Keith fucking Richards, appearing out of the ocean as if I'd conjured his spirit. Vaguely humming some song, lost in thought, he sauntered up the beach, looked at me and said, "Hey, man, how you doing?" I said, "Hey, Keith, I'm doing great. You?" "Fucking great," he said. "You got a smoke?" I said, "Yeah," and offered him a cigarette and my lighter. He lit up, inhaled, exhaled, threw his head back, surveyed our gorgeous surroundings, and then said, "Fantastic day, huh?" "Yeah, yeah, it is," I said. Then he handed me the lighter and started walking away. "All right, mate, catch you later." And that was it. It's probably the most major rock star move I've ever witnessed, emerging out of a warm teal ocean for a brief chat and smoke and then calmly disappearing over a breezy white sand dune, like an apparition. Fantastic day indeed. But he wasn't an apparition, because two nights later I walked into the empty hotel beach bar, which was essentially a fancy straw hut. There sat Keith, still barefoot, in the exact same outfit, but somehow looking fresh as a daisy, eyes brighter than diamonds. He was sipping a drink when he saw me and nonchalantly said, "Hey, kid, you got another smoke?" As if we had just seen each other like 2 minutes ago. I said, "Sure," and handed him one, which he lit up and exhaled. Then he offered this. "I saw a pod of dolphins today. Stunning sight." He took two more languorous hits off the cigarette, smiled a glowing smile, and said, "You know what's funny? Mick Jagger getting the bloody MBE from the Queen. Sir Mick fucking Jagger." He threw his wild, hairy head back with a deep, riotous laugh that lasted a full 5 seconds. Then there was a strange moment of awkward silence as he stared at the floor, humming some vague musical phrase. After a few more seconds of silence, he finished his drink, stood up in all his tan glory, and said, "All right, see you around, kid," and gracefully stepped out the door, taking an elegant turn into a lush tropical garden full of colorful bushes and towering plants. Within a heartbeat, he had evaporated into the darkness, leaving behind a hush of whispering leaves. I stared at the bartender for a second. Both of us smiled in amazement. Then I said, "Give me two of whatever he was having." About 5 years later, I was at a friend's birthday barbecue when I wandered off toward the tennis court, where a couple of people were whacking the ball around. I was watching them for a few seconds when I heard, "Hey man, can you go find me an ashtray?" I turned to see Keith, seated and coloring a unicorn in a kid's coloring book. "I am not shitting you." As I gathered in this visual, Keith said, "I need an ashtray and a hot pink crayon." I didn't know what to say, but this seemed appropriate. "A hot pink crayon?" "For the mane. I'm doing the body in blizzard blue," he said. "The tail's going to be electric lime. I think hot pink would be perfect for the mane. Or purple pizzazz. Or razzle dazzle rose. Any of those shades would do. And an ashtray." Again, not sure what to say, I blurted out, "Okay, I'll check in the house." So off I went, searching for fluorescent colored crayons for at least half an hour, in the kitchen, in the living room, in the basement, asking a bevy of people where I might find them, including some kids I came across in a playroom who I had to yell at because they weren't paying attention. "Hey guys," I said, "stop running around for a second and listen to me. I need your help here. Now shut up and listen for a minute." Needless to say, they were a little shocked, thinking they had done something wrong. So I tried to calm them down with a fun smile and this offering. "You guys ever seen The Sandlot?" That's a baseball movie I made in 1993 that became a big hit with kids of all ages, and it's still a favorite almost 25 years later. Several of these kids had seen it and answered yes. I smiled even bigger and charmingly explained who I was. "Well, I played the stepdad in that movie." "No, you didn't," a little girl immediately said. "Yes, I did," I replied sweetly. You're too old, another girl piped in. And wrinkly, some wise-ass boy said, which got a huge laugh and a couple of, look at his wrinkles, plus this. His face is melting, which got a massive laugh. I mean, fucking massive. They started chiming in on top of each other in a chorus of laughter and finger-pointing. His face is melting! His face is melting! They laughed and snickered and cackled until I snapped. God damn it, I really was the stepdad in Sandlot, and I need a hot pink fucking crayon, and I need it right fucking now, I shouted. And if you want to see someone with a wrinkly melting face, then come outside and see the guy I'm trying to find the fucking crayon for. The kids looked up at me in total confusion. A couple of them seemed to be on the verge of tears, but I didn't care anymore. But I knew I was going to have to apologize. That's when the wise ass reached into a box of crayons and pulled out a hot magenta, which looked pretty fucking pink to me. Plus, when I asked him if hot magenta was close to Razzle Dazzle Rose, he said, calm down, mister. You're very sweaty. Fucking kids. I left in a huff, without saying sorry. Grabbing an ashtray on my way out the kitchen door, I ran like Usain Bolt over to the tennis courts to find Keith, who was gone. As in, gone, gone. No coloring book, no crayons, no cigarette butts. I searched the grounds of the property for a long time. No sign of him. I started wondering if he was pissed at me. Then I started wondering if I had actually seen him at all. I went into the bathroom to take a piss and splash some water on my sweaty, wrinkly, melting candle of a face. What the fuck? Later on, as the birthday boy opened his presents, I saw him unroll a gently wrapped tube of paper with a ribbon around it. A neon blue unicorn with a bright lime green tail and mane, signed by Keith Richards. So it hadn't been some kind of fever dream after all. I haven't seen Keith since, but it wouldn't surprise me at all if I bumped into him 5 years from now in the strangest of circumstances, and he said, hey man, where's that fucking ashtray I asked you for? Cigarettes have often led to strange celebrity kinships for me. Like the one and only time I ever had the privilege to meet one of my all-time heroes, David Bowie. It was early in my career, just after I'd gotten big. We were both booked to appear on an English TV show, and I'd heard from two old comedian friends of mine, the brilliant Stephen Wright and Bobcat Goldthwait, that Bowie was a big comedy fan. They'd both had the opportunity to meet David after he'd seen them perform as they shot to fame in the early 80s. So I naturally assumed he'd be a fan of mine. Plus, I knew he smoked. When I got to the theater, the stage manager explained that in order to smoke, you had to step out a back door. In the lead-up to doing the show, I'd imagined what my conversation with Bowie would be like. Something along these lines. Bowie. Dennis, how are you? I've been so looking forward to meeting you. You're so funny. You're absolutely my favorite comedian. Me. Oh, thank you, David. That's awesome, man. But listen, you are my favorite rock star of all time. I mean, you bridged the gap for me when I was a teenager. Bowie. What gap was that? Me. When shitty prog rock and folky singer-songwriter pussies took over, like Seals and Crofts and Loggins and Messina and Bowie, I absolutely hated those assholes. Which reminds me, the asshole song, it's genius. Just genius. Let's sing it tonight. Me. Sing it where? Bowie. On the show. Me. What show? Bowie. This show. Me. You mean like in 2 hours? Bowie. Yes, in 2 hours. I had the band rehearse it once I found out you were going to be on. We've got it down, man. Me, but I don't, Bowie, I won't take no for an answer. I've already arranged it with the producer, and I've learned all the harmonies as well. Me, I don't know what to say. Bowie, I'll take that as a yes. Plus, I want you to have dinner with us after the show, then come to the studio. Me and the band are going to be jamming tonight, and I want to write a comedy tune. I've never really written one, and this would be the perfect opportunity. You and me as writing partners, mate. Me. Oh, wow. Okay. I'm in. Bowie. Listen, I've also got some copies of The Ref and No Cure for Cancer in my dressing room. Would you mind signing them for me? Me. Of course not. Pretty awesome, right? Now, here's how it really went. I stepped out into the alley and lit up a smoke when David Bowie said, pardon me, would you have a light? Me. Yes, yes. I'm Dennis, by the way. David Bowie. Hello, Dennis. I'm David. Me. I know. I'm like your biggest fan, man. I'm like a huge fan. Bowie. Oh, well, thank you. Me. I'm the comedian, Dennis Leary. Bowie. Oh, nice. I love stand-up comedy. Where are you from? New York? Me. Boston. I'm mostly in L.A. now because my career is really taking off, but Bowie. Boston. Do you know Stephen Wright? Me. Oh, yeah. I went to college with Stephen Wright. He and I, Bowie. Oh, my God. What's he like? I mean, I've met him. I'm like his biggest fan, but I didn't really get to know him, per se. Is he always that shy, or is it just like a persona? Me. Yeah, he's shy. I mean, I'm normally a little shy, too, even though my persona is the exact Bowie. He's a genius, Stephen Wright. Truly one of a kind. Now, what about Bobcat Goldthwait? I've met him as well. God, I'm such a huge fan of his. Did he always do that sort of punk rock comedy character? It's very original. Me. Totally, yeah. Speaking of original, can I tell you that Gene Genie was crew member? David, they're ready for sound check now. Bowie, to the crew member. Oh, thank you very much. To me, as he exits. Nice to meet you, Kevin. And the end. David walked away, and I stood, exhaling smoke. I saw him on stage that night, but never again met him in person. It wasn't the first time I was identified as an anonymous Kevin, but it was close to being the last. I got very famous within a year of my singular Bowie experience, and pretty soon, the only Kevin I'd be confused with was already a movie star. I was about to become living proof that fame is not only fleeting, it often moves so fucking fast that within the course of a single conversation, I could become several different people, and sometimes even manage to change gender, which is considered pretty cool these days. My next book, Erasing My Balls, by Dr. Dennis Leary. I love being famous. It's almost like being white. Chris Rock. All tall, skinny, famous white guys look alike. I used to have this showbiz dream that years after our encounter, Bowie would be sitting on a couch watching Mystic River when he'd point to Kevin Bacon on screen and tell him on, "Hey, I met that guy backstage in London once before he was famous." Kevin Bacon is low on my doppelganger list, but he does pop up from time to time. Almost always in airports. And when this happens, it usually involves a lot of passion on the part of his fans. And I guess because they are so passionate, I always feel it's important to explain why I'm not him. Which then takes at least 5 minutes because they say things like, "Okay, we get it. You're trying to keep a low profile. Can you take a quick photo? And tell Kira we love her." So at a certain point, I just stopped arguing and gave in. I'd sign Kevin's name and pose for a pic and promise to tell Kira, which took way less time and never came back to bite me in the ass. Until the summer of 2016. I jumped into an Uber vehicle in Manhattan, heading about 20 blocks to my apartment. Nice SUV, comfortable air conditioning, and some Frank Ocean playing on the stereo system. Calm, cool, and relaxed. After the normal hellos and "man, is it hot outside" patter between the driver and me, there was a moment of silence as we traveled along, listening to the music. Then I noticed the driver glancing at me in the rearview mirror. As we came to a red light and the car stopped moving, he did a full prairie dog on me, straightening his spine as he rose up 4 inches higher in the seat and momentarily froze in place, eyes wide with alert and locked on me in the mirror with full recognition. Like a meerkat spotting some dinner. "Footloose," he said. "I'm sorry," I said. "Footloose. You the footloose man." Ah, shit, I thought. Another fucking Kevin Bacon fan. My wife, she loved that movie. I love movie too. "You a great dancer, Kevin Bacon. I gotta take picture from my wife." As he fumbled for his phone, I thought about owning up and telling him I wasn't Kevin. But the light was about to change, and he seemed so excited and happy, plus there wasn't any traffic, and it was less than 10 minutes until he'd be dropping me off, so I made a split-second decision. "Did your wife like Mystic River?" I said. "The murder one with Sean Penn? Crazy good," he said. "We see everything you win, but we like Footloose the best." And now he leaned across the center console, held his phone at arm's length, and smiled. I did the same, put my arm around his shoulder, and click, 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 he took 3 fast photos. "Thank you, Kevin Bacon. My wife go crazy," he said. Then the light changed, and we were on our way again. I'd crossed a line now, and there was no going back. So I said, "Did you watch my TV show, The Following?" "Oh, my God, yes," he said. "So scary, very scary. And we watched your wife on her show. Your wife, a great actress. My wife, love your wife. She'd a closer. Ha, ha, ha." "Yep, she is," I said. "I'm a lucky guy." "My name is Manny," he said. "Nice to meet you, Manny. Nice to meet you, Kevin Bacon. Man, he had a smile bursting wide across his face. Total joy. Then he said, you do all the dancing in Footloose? Oh, yeah, I said, every single step. You a wonderful dancer. Thank you. Wait until I tell my wife. She won't believe this happened. Well, you have the pictures to prove it, I said. Yes, yes, I do. I knew the pictures would probably be a disappointment. His wife was likely to look at them, feel an itch of doubt, and then Google Kevin Bacon, coming to the sudden realization that the man in Manny's Uber was, in fact, an imposter. But that scene would take place hours from now when I was safely ensconced at home, never having to deal with the deception. I sat back and enjoyed the summery New York City sights, 6 more minutes to home, when I heard Manny say this. He's right here in the back seat, honey. Wait, hold on. Kevin. My wife on the phone. She don't believe Kevin Bacon is in my car. Say hello to her. Her name is Maru. And with that, he handed me the phone. Shit. No turning back now. Hello, Maru, I said. This is Kevin Bacon. Maru went quiet. Maru, are you there?
Yes. Hello, Kevin.
Hi. How are you?
I like your movies.
So I hear. Thank you. You're welcome. Is Kira there? No, she's not. She's at home.
Oh, that's too bad. I love the closer. When she won the Golden Globe and the Emmy, I was so happy for her. She deserved it, too. She was the best in that show.
That kind of pissed me off. Maru was not only disappointed that Kira Sedgwick wasn't also in Manny's Uber, but she was using her precious Kevin Bacon time to praise his absent wife's acting ability instead of my dancing. So I said this. You know, I won a Golden Globe, too, Maru.
You did?
Yes. Best Dramatic Actor. For Taking Chance?
Oh, I didn't see that one. Was Kira in it?
No, just me. It's on HBO Go. Very good movie. Award-winning. Okay. Nice talking to you, Maru.
Tell Kira I love her.
I will. Here's Manny. And with that, I handed Manny his phone. Stewing a little about the fact that even while pretending to be another famous actor, my fake award-winning talent gets overshadowed by the abilities of my also famous fake show business wife. This is why things never would have worked out between Kira and me. Her success and multiple major awards would have been a sticking point for my jealousy. Not to mention the fact that The Closer ran for 7 highly acclaimed seasons, while The Following was canceled after a critically panned 2. My overinflated ego and underlying insecurities would have ruined our relationship. But then I realized what a great guy Kevin Bacon was, so supportive of his wife. And I remembered how in love they seemed whenever they walked a red carpet together. They'd been happily married for almost 30 years. Plus, Kevin was apparently a great father. I changed my mind. You know what? It was an honor to be mistaken for such a wonderful man. That's when the SUV pulled over to the curb, and I heard this. Hey, what the hell, dude? Manny was parked and furious. He held up his phone. On it was a Google image of the actual Kevin Bacon, suddenly looking very unlike me. Maru say you don't sound like Kevin Bacon, and I say she crazy, but then I Google you up, and Maru is right. And now we know why, because you not him. Why you lie to me and my wife? Fuck. Fuck, fuck, fuck. I decided to come clean. Okay, I'm not Kevin Bacon, but I am a famous actor. Bullshit. I'm Dennis Leary.
Danny who?
Ugh. This was now becoming insane. I said, listen, maybe you don't know who I am, but a lot of people, you're a liar. Cut the bullshit and get the fuck out of my car before I call the cops. Get out. Get the fuck out. I give you 0 stars. And there I stood. Caught in a lie I only told to make someone feel better. Walking the hot Soho streets with sweaty pits and a shitty Uber rating, I went home, cranked the AC, and ordered in. And watched Footloose. 2 things struck me. Number one, I really don't look anything like Kevin Bacon. And number 2, the dancing didn't look all that hard. Until I tried to mimic some of the moves and pulled a hamstring. I get the fact that a lot of tall Irish guys named Kevin, Dennis, and Brian can look alike, even to other white people. Not to mention Beyonce. There are multiple guys named Kevin and Brian in my own family, along with a bevy of Michaels and Johns on both sides of the ocean. And many of us are physically built the same. Even my sister Anne-Marie looks a lot like me. Which might explain this next story. I was shooting an FX comedy series called Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll on the streets of New York City, playing a failed musician by the name of Johnny Rock. I had a shag haircut that could best be described as Rod Stewart meets Ziggy Stardust, and was sporting a very blousy rock star type of shirt, multiple necklaces and rings, plus a pair of very cool retro sunglasses, the kind Jackie Onassis wore back in the 70s. A crowd had gathered to watch us film, and as the actress Elaine Hendricks and I finished a relationship argument, my character walked off down the block. Seconds after the director shouted cut, a female fan of mine broke through the barriers and ran up to me breathlessly to say, "I'm your biggest fan, and I can't believe I'm seeing you, but I'm late for a meeting and I can't hang around. Could you just take one quick photo with me, please?" I said, "Of course I can. Anything for my biggest fan." So she whipped out her phone. I leaned in close to her and smiled broadly as she click, click, clicked, and then she beamed. "Thank you so much. I wish I could stay longer. Glee is my favorite show, and you are my favorite character. Bye!" As she rushed away waving, I waved back, realizing she thought I was Jane fucking Lynch, which had to be impossible. But I turned toward a plate glass store window a few feet away and took a gander at myself. Holy shit. I looked like Jane Lynch. In Jane's defense, a much manlier and far less pretty Jane Lynch. Really more like Jane Lynch's much older and weather-beaten brother. This happened a lot while I was shooting Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll, the common denominator being the days I was wearing a blousy shirt. Because whenever I was out in public dressed as Johnny but sporting a tight-fitting t-shirt, I wasn't Jane Lynch anymore. I somehow became John Bon Jovi. My co-stars included a trio of celebrity head-turners. Liz Gillies and Elaine Hendricks were gorgeous to begin with, but also well-known for iconic roles they had played. Teenage girls would go insane when they saw Jade from the hit Nickelodeon show Victorious walking the streets of New York and surround Liz begging for her autograph. Women in their 20s would freak out when they saw Elaine because her character in The Parent Trap was one of their all-time childhood favorites. Plus, everywhere we went, women of all ages would scream, "Aiden!" at John Corbett, still enamored of Sarah Jessica's dreamy boyfriend from Sex and the City. During production of our first season, a girl approached me on set and, for the only time in my career, ran the full famous guy gamut on me in one fell swoop. We were shooting on a busy street in Brooklyn and taking a break as the camera guys got ready to roll. So Elaine, Liz, and I were just standing outside a cafe, chatting away, when we noticed a woman in her 30s walk by twice, staring at us each time. On her third pass, she sidled shyly up to me and quietly said, "Excuse me, can I ask you a question?" She had an interesting accent, so I answered, "Yes, I love your accent, by the way. Do you mind if I ask where you're from?" "I'm from Belgium," she said. "Cool. I've been to Brussels. Loved it." She got even quieter now. "Are you, him?" Glad to be recognized by one of my European fans, I said, "Yep." "This," she said very loudly, "John Bon Jovi. I knew it." Elaine and Liz burst into gales of laughter. "He's not John Bon Jovi," Elaine explained. "Yes, he is." "Nope, he's not," Elaine replied. "He's somebody famous, though," Liz Gillies added. "A famous actor," Elaine clued. The girl looked me up and down again, then seemed to get it. "Yes, okay, wait, yes, you're a very good actor. I've seen you in many films. I know who you are." Elaine said, "Willem Dafoe?" And the girl went, "Yes, that's it. Willem Dafoe. Can I take a picture?" "He's not Willem Dafoe," Liz explained. That stopped her in her tracks. She narrowed her eyes, once more gave me the full up and down, then hopefully asked, "Kevin Bacon?" "No, I'm sorry, I'm not Kevin Bacon," I said. "He's Dennis Leary," Liz said. She went silent for a second, then it all dawned on her. "Oh," she said, "okay, right, right, now I see it. My mom loves you." She looked a little deflated and ready to move on. "Okay. Well, nice to meet you, Dennis," she said as she walked away. "You don't want to take a picture?" I implored. "No, no," she said. "That's okay. Thank you." And off she went, leaving all of us laughing in her wake. It's not every celebrity that can bring such disappointment on an international basis, as well as all over America. Once I was shooting a football movie called Draft Day in Cleveland, Ohio. My character had very short hair and often wore a sport coat and dressy pants, which is the outfit I had on one morning as I came out the front door of the hotel and noticed a lot of lesbians. I'm sure the last 5 words of that sentence will be considered sexist or genderist or judgy by recently hired sensitive readers, but I'm telling you, there is no other way to describe it. I was surrounded by lesbians. Lesbians in small chatty circles, lines of lesbians getting some kind of credentials from a table full of lesbians,
and a stream of other lesbians coming out of several luxury lesbian buses and jumbo lesbo passenger vans. I had no idea what the hell was going on until I heard this. Ellen, oh my God, are you here for the convention? This woman thought I was Ellen DeGeneres, attending the Cleveland Pride weekend, and the woman who singled me out was part of an Ohio lesbian delegation who had meetings and events planned at my hotel, along with a full 3 days of other celebrations. A couple of her friends lasered in on me, too. Hey, Ellen DeGeneres is here. Are you marching in the parade? Where's Portia? Now, I know as some men get older, we start to look like aging lesbians. There's nothing we can do about that except maybe plastic surgery, which I'm never doing. This is my face, for better or worse. Mostly worse from here on out. And I don't have a problem with that. What I do have a problem with is this. Ellen has much better skin than me, far fewer wrinkles, and way more feminine eyes. Fortunately, the majority of women around me that morning agreed with my summation. That's not Ellen, one said. He's a guy, for Christ's sake. You are somebody, though. Who are you? Another said. I'm Dennis Leary. No, you're not. Dennis Leary has much longer hair. Such is life. I only get mistaken for Ellen once every 5 years or so. But every single time, my hair is short, and I have on a t-shirt and pants with a sport coat. Hey, I'm not stereotyping here. I'm the victim of a stereotype. But I have to say, the level of excitement and animated joy that springs from Ellen's fans when they think I might be her makes me a very willing one. Now, just as a form of review, let's make an official list. People Dennis Leary is most often mistaken for. Number one, Willem Dafoe, all the time, anywhere. Number two, Bryan Adams, by some people, but especially Beyonce. Number three, Bon Jovi, if I sport a t-shirt, shag haircut, and jewelry. Number four, Jane Lynch, with shag haircut, blousy shirt, and jewelry. Five, Ellen DeGeneres, with short haircut, t-shirt, no jewelry. Six, Kevin Bacon, only in airports, Belgium, or by Uber drivers. Number seven, Christopher Walken, once by an Hispanic security guard. Let me explain number seven. I was working at an editing facility in New York City a couple of years ago and headed out for a smoke when I stopped to tell the security guard, hey, I'm just going to have a quick smoke and come back in, but I forgot my pass card. No problem, he said. I won't forget you, Mr. Walken. I said thanks and ambled outside, a bit distracted by the project we were working on upstairs, when it hit me, that guy thinks I'm Christopher Walken? Chris Walken is a friend of mine. Chris Walken is a talented guy. Chris Walken is an Oscar-winning actor. And 14 fucking years older than me. I glanced at myself in the building's front door glass. No way I looked that old. I didn't want to get into an argument with the guy or ask someone passing by on the sidewalk who they thought I was, but I also didn't want to be Chris Walken to this security guard for the next 3 fucking weeks while I was coming in and out of this building. So I Googled Suicide Kings, a culty heist movie Chris and I did back in the late 90s. He played a kidnapped mob boss, and I was his devoted right-hand man on a mad search to find him. Voila. First image up was Chris and I standing side by side, leaning on the hood of a car and staring straight into the camera. I had extremely close-cropped short hair and rock star cool sunglasses on and looked a lot younger than Chris. So on my way back in, I stopped at the front desk and proudly showed this photo to the security guy, pointed to my image, and smiled. He was very impressed. Holy shit. When did you do a movie with Sting? Suffice to say, it took 15 minutes and another 25 Google photos for me to prove who I actually was. And you know what finally did the deed? My voice. His kids were huge fans of Diego from the Ice Age movies. Thank God. Side note to Kellyanne Conway, if you're bummed out about people saying you and I resemble each other, do yourself a favor. Don't cut the fucking hair. The one and only time I prayed to be mistaken for some other celebrity happened 2 summers ago. I was driving back from Detroit. Let me start by saying I drive everywhere. I love seeing this great country of ours from ground level. I also love playing my favorite music very loud on big truck speakers. And I only drive trucks, whether it's a large SUV or a pickup. Why? Because I can. Do they eat gas and cause climate change? You bet your fucking ass they do. Listen, build me a truck that travels on chia seeds and I'll be the first guy in line to buy it. Until then, fuck you. Call Sting and set up another rainforest benefit. So, I'm driving back from Detroit.
And despite what you're about to hear, just like most Americans, I usually use the state-run rest stops when I have to go to the bathroom. But this one particular morning, I miscalculated. I had been visiting some Detroit Fire Department friends of mine for a Leary Firefighters Foundation charity presentation and doing some local media to drum up funding. Now, I'm a worst-case scenario type of guy, what I like to call an optimistic pessimist. I always expect the absolute baddest possible thing to happen, and I look forward to getting it over with. It's an approach that has served me well. Think about it. I'm the son of Irish immigrants raised in Massachusetts. When I was 6 years old, they assassinated our Boston-born first-ever Irish president, and when I was 10, our baseball team, the Red Sox, lost the World Series under a cloud of ill will that during decades of subsequent near misses would become known as the Curse of the Bambino. Lesson learned. If you got your hopes up too high, someone was bound to crush them like a bug. So, I'm driving. Back from Detroit. I'd eaten a big breakfast at the hotel that morning, and just as I left the room, grabbed a roll of toilet paper and threw it into my gym bag. Why? Because JFK got his fucking head blown off, that's why. Because of Bill Buckner in 1986. Don't know what that refers to? Google the misery, which is over now because the Red Sox have won 3 World Series championships in less than 10 years. Talk about hope and change. So, driving, Detroit, me. Listening to some old Motown hits, very, very loud, about an hour or so outside the city. When Mike Colon sends a message. We have to take a crap. Okay. Should have gone before I left the hotel, but not an immediate problem. I can hold it for at least another 10 minutes. Wait until the next rest stop. I've done it a million times. We all have. 2 more songs and a public toilet. Perfect timing. Marvin Gaye on the mix. Moving along at a cool 95 miles per hour when I see a highway sign ahead. I can tell it's next rest stop sign, so I'm feeling pretty good. Until I get a little closer. Close enough to read the entire thing. Now, I don't remember exactly what the sign said, but I do recall the gist of it. Next rest stop, you should have worn a diaper. It was some crazy number, like 36 miles. In other words, an entire album away. I cinched up my sphincter as tight as I could, but it was a losing proposition. We've all been there. That moment in time when you suddenly realize you have no more butt muscle control. Plus, you're in a seated position, so as far as your anus is concerned, it's already go time. My colon was sending me emergency signals, cramping up. If my ass was on Twitter, this tweet would have been hashtagged, have to take it now. No exits in sight. No exits listed on the GPS until after the next rest stop. And 35 miles to go. I had no other option. So I picked a leafy, green area with a nice chunk of woods and an already trodden path coming out of it, as if quite a few other people had pulled over and walked into it to take a piss. So I cleverly parked in front of that path, knowing the big Ford F-150 would block me from anyone's view while I went about my business. Which it did. I know, because in the precious little time between me exiting the truck and the crap exiting my colon, I focused in on what was in front of me. The last thing I wanted was to be in a squatting position with my pants around my ankles when a state trooper showed up. But now, my ass made it clear. Bombs away. I had maybe 2 seconds until release. So there I was. Roll of toilet paper in one hand, belt buckle in the other as my pants fell around my ankles and I squatted down. Bam! It was over that fast. What the hell? I don't think I ever took that quick a shit in my life. One bend and I was done. And I mean, done. Nothing left inside. And my colon felt cleansed. For years, Jimmy Kimmel and Howard Stern had been talking about how great the squatty potty is and squatty potty this and squatty potty that. Those two could talk for hours about how the squat position was healthier, more natural, and better for your entire digestive system. They even talked about squatty potty on Howard's radio show. It's a wood footrest you place next to the toilet that forces your body into a more beneficial bathroom position. I always thought they were out of their minds, until I was standing in these Michigan woods, staring down at what was quite possibly the most perfect poop I'd ever taken. And then I realized, Howard and Jimmy were geniuses. I barely had to wipe, which was when I heard, "Hey man, what the fuck?" I looked up to see a fence. And just inside that fence, about 40 horrified people at a cookout. And their kids. That's when it dawned on this thick Irish skull. I'd never looked behind me. I certainly thought I'd glance deeper into the woods on my way in, But really, I was so concerned about someone seeing me from the highway side that the last few yards of entry had been spent facing forward, just like the 40 people staring at me right now and their kids. So I did what you would have done. I pulled up my pants and ran like a bat out of hell, tossing the roll of toilet paper into the bushes. It sounded like a couple of angry fathers jumped the fence and were headed up the path in chase because I heard a few more, "Hey's! Hey, asshole!" That seemed to be getting closer as I jumped into my truck and peeled away. Want to know how fast a Ford pickup goes from 0 to 80 miles per hour? Here's the answer. Pretty fucking fast. And the whole time I was praying, please let them think it was Willem Dafoe or John Bon Jovi, anyone but me. 25 years after gaining notoriety, I'm speeding down a Michigan highway hoping people don't remember me at all, which is perfect for so many reasons. When my MTV rants and hit one-man show No Cure for Cancer first caught fire back in 1992, I was considered the next big thing. Movie offers and magazine covers followed, and as my name got bigger, so did my ego, which is where my wife comes in. She would cut me back down a size every time I got too full of myself, reminding me that I wasn't really a movie star. I was a father and a husband who happened to make movies for a living. Because in the end, that's the only legacy anyone leaves behind. Family. How you treated and loved your significant other bears a spiritual witness even after you've departed. And if you have children, how they are raised speaks an enduring volume about your moral backbone and beliefs. As do your closest friends and relatives. Charity also counts. To whom much is given, much is expected in return. I picked that nugget up from my parents. My mom's proud that I'm successful, but far prouder of what I might have accomplished as a dad, and how I use my fame for lending a helping hand to people less fortunate than we are. My parents should have honorary doctorates. Dr. John Leary was a devoted father who taught me a strong work ethic and how to judge people by character instead of skin color. Dr. Nora Leary taught me family values, good citizenship, and how housewives like her actually created feminism by empowering their daughters on a daily basis. My wife, Dr. Ann Leary, showed me how important my kids are and the proper place for all the Hollywood bullshit. But just like my friend Dr. Lenny Clark, first I had to learn how to listen. I'm doing a lot of good deeds now to make up for all the idiotic behavior I perpetrated earlier on. So I glommed onto this cold, hard fact. Fame is not forever. It is forever ephemeral. Each celebrity name and face is a cotton candy idea that brings a sugary smile or breathy swoon for several years or so, but eventually melts away into empty calorie oblivion. Think about it. These days, if you mention a handsome movie star with debonair comic ability and the last name Grant, most people think of Hugh, not Carrie. Remember Paul Newman? My kids thought he was a chef because his smiling face adorned every bottle of salad dressing and each microwave popcorn bag they ingested for the first 15 years of their lives. Until we force-fed them Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid one summer evening, and then they wondered who the blonde guy was and what the fuss was all about. But once Robert Redford appeared opposite Chris Evans in Captain America, then they thought he was cool. An entire generation of kids don't know who Johnny Carson was. Never mind almost every single guest who ever appeared on his show. My nieces and nephews think of Goldie Hawn as Kate Hudson's mother. 70s box office king Burt Reynolds is now known as the old guy from Boogie Nights. And John Wayne is recognized as the first two names of a famed murderous clown called Gacy. Serial killers are much more likely to be remembered than cinematic stars. Such is the nature of the insatiable fame beast. A very precious few entertainers get chosen to light up the sky for posterity. Mostly musicians, which I think has to do with the power of a 3-minute miracle. A memorable song that makes your feet move or your heart glow while imbuing the soul with longing and inspiration. Frank Sinatra and the Rolling Stones. Louis Armstrong and Janis Joplin. Judy Garland and David Bowie are all artists my kids came to know on their own. Not to mention Tony Bennett and the Beatles. The song White Christmas may be the only connection this generation has with Bing Crosby, but that holiday number will keep his name on American lips until time stands still. Nick Lowe? Nope. The Replacements? Not a chance. For millennials, Iggy Pop might have started out as the guy who sang Search and Destroy on an Audi commercial, and The Clash as the band behind the Choice Hotels tune, Should I Stay or Should I Go? But that brief TV exposure leads to downloads of their other music and makes them legendary all over again. Doesn't work that way for old TV shows and their stars, though. Columbo is mourned as a favorite brand of yogurt that left the dairy shelves in 2010 instead of the magnificent show starring Peter Falk, who died a year later. Remember Hill Street Blues?